The Mediterranean Caper by Clive Cussler. Dedication. To Amy and Eric, long may they wave. Prologue. It was oven hot, and it was Sunday. In the air traffic tower, the control operator at Brady Air Force Base lit a cigarette from a still glowing butt, propped his stocking feet on top of a portable air conditioner, and waited for something to happen. He was totally bored, and for good reason. Air traffic was slow on Sundays. In fact, it was nearly non-existent. Military pilots and their aircraft rarely flew on that day in the Mediterranean theater of operations, particularly since no international political trouble was brewing at the moment. Occasionally, a plane might set down or take off, but it was usually just a quick refueling stop for some VIP who was in a hurry to get to a conference somewhere in Europe or Africa. The control operator scanned the large flight schedule blackboard for the 10th time since he came on duty. There were no departures, and the only estimated time of arrival was at 16:30, almost 5 hours away. He was young, in his early 20s, and strikingly refuted the myth that fair-haired people cannot tan well. Wherever skin showed, it looked like dark walnut laced with strands of platinum blonde hair. The four stripes on his sleeve denoted the rank of a staff sergeant, and although the temperature was touching 98 degrees, the armpits of his khaki uniform displayed no damp sweat stains. The collar on his shirt was open and missing a tie, a custom normally allowed at Air Force facilities located in warm atmospheres. He leaned forward and adjusted the louvers on the air conditioner so that the cool air ran up his legs. The new position seemed to satisfy him, and he smiled at the refreshing tingle. Then, clasping his hands behind his head, he relaxed backward, staring at the metal ceiling. The ever-present thought of Minneapolis and the girls parading Nicolette Avenue crossed his mind. He counted again the 54 days left to endure before he was rotated back to the States. When each day came, it was ceremoniously marked off in a small black notebook he carried in his breast pocket. Yawning for perhaps the 20th time, he picked up a pair of binoculars that were sitting on the window ledge and surveyed the parked aircraft that rested on the dark asphalt runway stretching beneath the elevated control tower. The runway lay on the island of Thassos in the northern part of the Aegean Sea. The island was separated from the Greek Macedonia mainland by 16 miles of water, appropriately called the Thassos Strait. The Thassos landmass consisted of 170 square miles of rock, timber, and remnants from classical history dating back to 1000 BC. Brady Field, as generally termed by the base personnel, was constructed under a treaty between the United States and the Greek government in the late 1960s. Except for 10 F-105 Starfire jets, the only other permanently based aircraft were two monstrous C-133 Cargomaster transports that sat like a pair of fat silver whales, glistening in the blazing Aegean sun. The sergeant pointed the binoculars at the dormant aircraft and searched for signs of life. The field was empty. Most of the men were either in the nearby town of Panagia drinking beer, sunbathing on the beach, or napping in the air-cooled barracks. Only a solitary MP guarding the main gate, and the constant rotation of the radar antennae atop its cement bunker, offered any form of human presence. He slowly raised the lenses and peered over the azure sea. It was a bright, cloudless day, and he could easily recognize details on the distant Greek mainland. The glasses swung east and gathered in the horizon line where deep blue water met light blue sky. Through the shimmering haze of heat waves, the white speck of a ship resting at anchor came into view. He squinted and adjusted the focus knob to clarify the ship's name on the bow. He could just barely make out the tiny black words, "First Attempt." That's a dumb name, he thought. The significance escaped him. Other markings also darkened the ship's hull. In long, heavy black lines across the center of the hull were the vertical letters NUMA, which he knew stood for the National Underwater Marine Agency. A huge crooked crane stood on the stern of the ship and hung over the water, lifting a round ball-like object from the depths. The sergeant could see men laboring about the crane, and he felt inwardly glad that civilians had to work on a Sunday too. Suddenly, his visual exploration was cut short by a robot-like voice over the intercom. "Hello, Control Tower. This is Radar. Over." The sergeant laid down the binoculars and flicked a microphone switch. "This is the Control Tower, Radar. What's up?" "I've got a contact about 10 miles to the west."
10 miles west," boomed the sergeant. "That's inland over the island. Your contact is practically on top of us."
He turned and looked again at the big-lettered blackboard, reassuring himself that no scheduled flights were due. "Next time, let me know sooner."
"Beats me where it came from," droned the voice from the radar bunker. "Nothing has shown on the scope in any direction under 100 miles in the last 6 hours."
"Well, either stay awake down there or get your damn equipment checked," snapped the sergeant. He released the mic button and grabbed the binoculars. Then he stood up and peered to the west. It was there, a tiny dark dot flying low over the hills at treetop level. It came slow, no more than 90 miles an hour. For a few moments it seemed to hang suspended over the ground, and then, almost all at once, it began to take on shape. The outlines of the wings and fuselage drew into sharp focus through the binoculars. It was so clear as to be unmistakable. The sergeant gaped in astonishment as the rattly bang engine sound of an old single-seat bi-wing airplane, complete with rigid spoked wheel landing gear, tore the arid island air. Except for the protruding inline cylinder head, the fuselage followed a streamlined shape that tapered to straight sides at the open cockpit. The great wooden propeller beat the air like an old windmill, pulling the ancient craft over the landscape at a tortoise-like airspeed. The fabric-covered wings wavered in the wind and showed the early characteristic scalloped trailing edge. From the spinner enclosing the propeller hub to the rear tips of the elevators, the entire machine was painted a bright and flamboyant yellow. The sergeant lowered the glasses just as the plane, displaying the familiar black Maltese cross markings of World War I Germany, flashed by the control tower. In another circumstance, the sergeant would have probably dropped to the floor if an airplane buzzed the control tower at no more than 5 feet. But his amazement at seeing a very real ghost from the dim skies of the Western Front was too much for his senses to grasp, and he stood stock still. As the plane passed, the pilot brazenly waved from his cockpit. He was so close that the sergeant could see the features of his face under the faded leather helmet and goggles. The specter from the past was grinning and patting the butts of the twin machine guns mounted on the cowling. Was this some sort of colossal joke? Is the pilot a nutty Greek with a circus? Where did he come from? The sergeant's brain spun with questions, but no answers. Suddenly he became aware of twin blinking spots of light, emitting behind the propeller of the plane. Then the glass of the control tower windows shattered and disappeared around him. A moment in time stopped, and war came to Brady Field. The pilot of the World War I fighter dipped around the control tower and strafed the sleek modern jets parked lazily on the runway. One by one, the F-105 Starfires were raked and slashed by ancient 8mm bullets that tore into their thin aluminum skin. Three of them burst into flames as their full tanks of jet fuel ignited. They burned fiercely, melting the soft asphalt into smoking puddles of tar. Again and again the bright yellow flying antique soared over the field, spitting a leaden stream of destruction. One of the C-133 cargo masters went next. It erupted in a gigantic roar of flames that rose hundreds of feet into the air. In the tower, the sergeant lay on the floor, looking dazedly at a red trail of blood that oozed from his chest. He gently pulled the black notebook from his breast pocket and stared in fascinated surprise at a small, neat hole in the middle of the cover. A dark veil began to circle his eyes, and he shook it off. Then he struggled to his knees and looked around the room. Glittering fragments of broken glass blanketed the floor, the radio equipment, the furniture.
In the center of the room, the air conditioner lay upside down like a dead mechanical animal, its legs thrown stiffly in the air and its coolant trickling onto the floor from several round punctures. The sergeant dully peered up at the radio. Miraculously, it was untouched. Painfully, he crawled across the floor, slicing his knees and hands on the crystal slivers. He reached the microphone and grasped it tightly, bloodying the black plastic handle. Darkness crowded the sergeant's thoughts. What is the proper procedure, he wondered. What does one say at a time like this? Say something, his mind shouted. Say anything. To all who can hear my voice, Mayday! Mayday! This is Brady Field. We are under attack by an unidentified aircraft. This is not a drill. I repeat, Brady Field is under attack.